Looking to build a web developer portfolio but not sure where to start? Go to techrally.co and click courses to sign up for the Practical Portfolio course. You will use HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and GitHub to not only build your application, but also deploy to Netlify. Start your software developer journey with a strong portfolio at techrally.co. Welcome to Outside the Code, a show about the stories behind the professionals in the tech industry. I'm Alex from Tech Rally, and on the show today, we talk to James Quick, a developer advocate who has a passion for teaching developers through content. As consumers of social media like YouTube and Twitter, do we really know the person behind the online profile? In this conversation with James, we go over his early days before he knew that developer advocacy was his calling. We also dive deep into finding motivation through others to achieve a goal that at one time seemed impossible. I'm super excited about this conversation. Let's get to it. Hey, James, how are you doing?
Hey, what's going on? I'm doing good.
Not much, man. Thanks for coming on for this podcast.
Yeah, well, you offered, I think it was in like the collaborations channel, or maybe you mentioned on our YouTube meeting that we were just talking about, and then I was like, yeah, I'd love to jump on and hang out.
You know what's funny? We actually talked right before I hit the record button about were we ever in a same like video space together, and that's probably where I announced it. So
yeah,
I'm pretty sure you messaged me. Yeah, my memory is coming back to me now.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah. So what do you think about updating documentation or keeping things up to date? What's your opinion about that?
Should always be up to date.
Yeah,
I mean that's like that's one of the worst things that can happen from a developer experience, right? Like try out a new product, it doesn't work, then you don't want to try the product anymore.
Yeah, and like in some regards, you could consider yourself as the product. So I have a question for you. Can you tell me if this is good or not? After completing his degree in computer science at Vanderbilt University, James worked for Microsoft for 3 years as a tech evangelist in New York City and Miami, and is currently working at FedEx Services in Memphis as a full-stack web developer.
Where did you find this?
On LinkedIn, actually.
On LinkedIn. Okay. Yeah, there's so many places to update bios. Like, I actually have a snippet now on my computer that's Z bio. So if I type that, it'll like autocomplete the full thing, which is updated, but I haven't gotten it in every place. So I guess that's one of them.
That's the difficulty when you have so many different platforms that you need to kind of reach out to, right? Because I know you have a TikTok, you have YouTube, you're probably doing a bunch of Twitter spaces on Twitter, and then now there's too many platforms out there.
Yeah, it definitely is. I'm gonna like behind the scenes go and update that now so that by the time anybody goes and looks, it should be
oh man. If you got anything out of this podcast as a guest, is that you now have an updated LinkedIn.
That's right. And I kind of like you threw the question out there and I was like, I feel like this is leading somewhere. I just didn't know where yet.
That's why I asked you, like, hey, do you watch my previous episodes? Because usually I kind of throw them a curveball right off the bat, and they're just kind of like, oh, I did not expect that. Usually a lot of other shows or stuff, I notice they start off with, oh, like, can you give us a quick intro about yourself? And that's kind of, I want to change it up a little bit.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I kind of struggle too with doing a bunch of, like you said, podcasts, my own, being a guest, YouTube videos, like all the things, and you end up telling the same story a lot. So
exactly,
some sort of different take on it, which is what you mentioned going back to the conversation that, or at least when I heard you announced it inside of our Discord chat. I was like, I'm kind of curious where this is going to go, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, let's dive deep a bit. You know what's funny though? It's like I watched like 4 of your interviews, and weirdly enough, a lot of good content, but I don't know who you are. And it's funny because you give a lot of good information and you say that, oh, I want people to get my personality or see my personality through my TikTok videos. But you also know that TikTok maybe is like 10, 15 seconds, 30 seconds. And in some regards, do you feel like people are getting to know who you are through your content, minus just like the pure like teaching perspective, but just like who is James Q. Quick?
Yeah, I think the ideal scenario is actually like hanging out with people in real life. Like that's the actual, I wish I had more of that. Obviously COVID has made that more difficult. We're opening up more to doing like in-person stuff. So I've actually got several conferences that I'll be going to, and that's going to be a blast. So nothing quite matches up to that. But yeah, I think TikTok for me, like, I don't know that people are learning anything like super personal about me, but they're learning that I've got a different side to me than just the like, here's how you create this app, which is fun, right? And that's kind of where I've been known the most on YouTube specifically. But now I get to like poke fun at different things and also use it as kind of like an inspirational thing or a motivational thing. So you like, you poke fun at like bad managers, bad employers, bad cultures, that kind of stuff. And it's funny and it's entertaining. So that's part of it. But it's also like realization that things don't have to be that way. Like if you're in a shitty situation, I'm assuming I can curse on here. If you're in a shitty situation, then like, what can you do to start to work to fix that? What do you need to find a new job? Do you need to start looking? Do you need to build extra skills so that you can go find a new job or a new company, a new boss, whatever it is? So yeah, I think it's got multiple benefits. And at the end of the day, I think for me, it's kind of fun. It's entertainment and it does give a little bit of a different perspective of me that people probably don't see as much in just the regular, YouTube tutorial.
I definitely follow you on TikTok, and I'm pretty sure you follow me too. And I resonate exactly how you feel, because my YouTube is a little bit more tutorial centric. And now these days I'm doing these podcasts. So it's a little bit, you get to see my personality, how I get to grill the people I'm interviewing and whatnot. So it's really fun in that regards. But just to rewind back and just to get to know you a little bit better, I know you went to Vanderbilt and you kind of grew up in Tennessee. What was it like growing up in that area?
So I am grew up in Memphis, actually still live in Memphis now, which is like very inner city. I don't know the best way to describe that, like very urban, I guess. I don't know. So like, interestingly, the school system here is like really, really bad across the board. So I went to public school, like the one, I would say like the one public school that kind of stands out in the city. But it had this really great mix of like diversity in a lot of different factors, like income wise, like neighborhood wise, not intelligence level, because I don't think that's fair, but like interest in formal education type thing, right? Like there's a lot of people who are super talented, super smart, and not interested in school, which I've like realized more and more in the tech industry is like just really common for people where that's not how people learn. And the more I've taught, the more I realize that like, teachers don't necessarily do a good job a lot of the time of like making things personal for people and making it relate to people and making it something that they care about. Cause if you don't care, it's really hard to want to learn. So anyway, I think like my high school, people make fun of me cause I talk about it all the time. It's like the perfect example of diversity of race, religion, sex, socioeconomic, like everything that you could think of. And then I ended up going to Vanderbilt, which is a private school. And I was actually kind of nervous about that, like thinking about like lack of diversity, assuming there would be lack of diversity, assuming that everybody there would have a ton more money than I had, and being a little self-conscious about that, honestly. And there was definitely some of that, but Vanderbilt was an amazing experience as well. Like there was definitely some of the stereotypes of going to a private university, but the people that I spent the most time with, I think, kind of reflected what I grew up with, which is just lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds. And I think the older I got, which sounds like an old thing to say, I've started to appreciate people more for just who they are and their interests. Like it's easy growing up to think that people that are interested in something that you're not, that they're weird or whatever, but it's just people are different, right? Like I have a ton of different quirks that other people would think are weird or goofy or whatever. So I think that's been kind of a progression for me of just really enjoying learning from about different people, their backgrounds, cultures, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think growing up here, that was probably the biggest takeaway for me. It was just a good range of diversity, especially in school.
What schools were you struggling with in terms of it's either Vanderbilt or somewhere else? Did you kind of have a multitude of options that you were considering?
Not really, mainly because I applied early decision to Vanderbilt. So Vanderbilt was the only school that I visited. And at the time, I visited a friend of mine who was a year older that went to my high school. And he told me that they got 4 meals a day. So what they would do is they would go eat their 3 meals. And then at midnight or like whenever they would go and just get snacks, and they would hoard these snacks in their dressers and stuff. So I like got to his dorm room and he was like, here, have some whatever you want out of this like huge snack drawer. And I was like, sold. Like I'm going to Vanderbilt because I want 4 meals a day, which ironically, when I got there, they changed it to 3 meals a day. So I was like super disappointed to not have fourth meal is what they called it.
I guess you avoided the freshman 15, like they say. So
I probably still would have preferred to have the snacks, but I would say it worked out eventually. Yeah.
Did you know that you always wanted to do computer science before you got to Vanderbilt? Oh.
No, like hard. I had no idea.
That's so funny. Like, how did you decide on that?
Completely random. So I was trying really? To take computer science my senior year of high school. And a little bit about fun fact about me. I was a 4-year orchestra student, played the violin.
Oh, me too.
Oh, nice. Sweet. See, these are the things that don't often come out in conversations. I haven't played since, by the way. So
me too.
Okay, good. I don't want to do great. Like a comparison thing.
No, this is exactly the same path we're going. Yeah,
nice. So I really enjoyed that. And going into senior year, I wanted to take AP CompSci, but it was at the same time. And I wasn't going to give up my fourth year of orchestra in high school. So I did that instead. And the only reason I was going to take it was just because a few of my friends were like, I still didn't know anything about it. And then I got into Vanderbilt to the engineering school specifically. And then they sent me an email that said, what are you going to study? Like, what's your major? I was like, I don't have any clue, to be honest. Like, I don't want to do like, I don't want to be a doctor. I don't want to be like biomed, and I don't like biology and chemistry. And so I literally just like computer science. Okay. Like, we'll just run with that. And obviously it's worked out really well since, awesome. Because I love it, but I literally had no idea what it was at the time.
That's crazy, actually. I mean, I did mechanical engineering. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it either, in a sense. I just knew that I liked physics, but from what I could tell, you know, being in a lab or whatever as a physics major probably won't get me a job, maybe. So that's what I was thinking in my head. So maybe if I add the word engineering in the end, there might be some job opportunities there. So that's kind of what I was thinking when I joined. But did you know that? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, at least you had some sort of like foresight into job. Like that was never like CS101 the first day. Like they showed some stats of like, this is a good place to be for jobs. And I'm like, I've never considered that before. And like, I just literally had no idea. So I'm thankful that it worked out the way it did.
But speaking of jobs, I mean, I'm assuming based on your third or fourth year, you're kind of considering like, what is out there, right? And I know that you became a tech evangelist at Microsoft, but before that, you were kind of doing some SQL stuff at FedEx. Like, were you getting a hint or a taste of what your job could be like at that moment? And did you think that this was going to be the final thing that you do? Or because obviously now you do web development, but at that time, your scope was probably limited to whatever was that first job or second job. Like, how was that? How did that feel for you? Did you like it?
Super limiting. Like I had no idea what options were out there, which I think is always why one of my biggest pieces of advice, whether you're going through a degree or whatever, to learn to code, like just be involved in the community so that you can like see what other people do. Cause I had an internship at FedEx, which was great. It was like hands-on learning experience. It was like writing bash scripts and doing some basic SQL stuff I'd never done before. So that was cool. But I was never exposed to web development technically I was, but it was kind of a joke class. So for the most part, I wasn't exposed to that. I didn't have really very practical knowledge coming out of college. And I didn't know anything other than whatever recruiter said when they showed up. Like I didn't do outside research. I wasn't taking control of my situation and trying to figure out exactly what I wanted and what those opportunities would look like. So Microsoft recruited on campus. They recruited for software engineering roles. I applied, had interviews, got rejected. They still liked me. So they said, what about a technical account manager role? Had no idea what that was. And I was like, sure. So I flew out to DC. They interviewed me, declined me, and put me in a limo with a group of other people that had gotten declined back to the hotel. So that was like a really awkward experience. And then they said tech evangelist, because they still thought I would be a good fit for the company, just not those roles. And I was like, I've never, like, that sounds obviously made up. And it wasn't. And that seemed to be the perfect thing of like me being a social person, liking being around and interacting and learning and teaching. Actually, I don't know if I knew the teaching part then, but just being around people and loving to kind of coming into this idea of loving to build stuff. And it ended up being a perfect fit and kind of the jumpstart for my career.
Yeah. And I wouldn't blame you for not knowing exactly what you needed to do at what, 20 years old, 21 years old. Like, I didn't even know what I wanted to do. I worked at Samsung for about 3 years because it was a job that paid me money. But if I knew that I would have hated this job, regardless of what, how much they paid me, I probably would have started web development sooner than later. And I always ask myself, if I should have just left like a year and a half. Not 3 years, right? But everyone has their like steps to get there. But I am actually curious about what you said, because you said you love being around people, but I could have sworn I heard you say you're more introverted than extroverted. Would you say you're more of like an introverted extrovert or extroverted introvert? How's that work?
Yeah, it definitely depends on the situation. So like around people I know and people I'm already comfortable with, I'm usually the loudest, most obnoxious one, which is like, again, part of my personality that I don't really... It's hard to portray that in a YouTube video or a TikTok, so most people wouldn't know that. But I'm not super into hanging out with people that I don't know yet. Like being at a conference and not knowing someone is really tough for me, because I can be super social and like go up and introduce myself and start a conversation, but I just really hate small talk. And I, at this point in my life, I just really want to hang around people that I know I want to hang around with, which is like, sometimes not such a good thing, because I'm not as open to meeting new people as I should be. I can definitely be quiet in certain instances, but in general with people that I know, even if it's just for a short time, but I've connected with, I can definitely be one of the loudest people in a group.
I think with this YouTube community that we have, it really opens the door for you to be able to do that, because before we had our little group Discord kind of thing, it was just hard to be like, oh yeah, this is a tech YouTuber who's in the same field as me, but you just kind of know them by their YouTube channel, right? But now that we kind of have these accountability meetings and stuff like that, I really think I get a good personality of who other people are. And that's really been helpful for me. But July of 2013 is when you start your tech evangelist job. Like, did Microsoft just have some kind of like magic eight ball or some kind of I could see the future kind of thing of what developer advocacy would be in 2022? Like, were you already a developer advocate at 2013 in some regards?
Yeah, that's basically what it was. I mean, we've kind of moved. I think evangelist is just such a weird title and it has such like religious connotations that like it's an interesting conversation starter, because you say your title and they're like so like there's that interesting aspect of it, but I don't think it represented what we did / what advocates do now. And so you started to see like Google and Amazon start to call them developer advocates. Now all those types of roles at Microsoft are developer advocate, and that's what I see going forward. So yeah, I would say Microsoft had a pretty early version of evangelism that then has kind of evolved into what we think of as developer marketing, developer relations, developer advocates, whichever one of those categories you want to throw it in.
Yeah, I think that from that point of view, it's kind of crazy how they already thought about that so early on. And obviously, I wonder, do they still call it tech evangelist or is it developer advocate for them as well?
Yeah, so that whole organization that I was in has been disbanded like not too long after I left. So maybe I can take, like, they just couldn't continue on without me. I don't know. But similar positions that they have now are developer advocates.
Got it. And I'm definitely going to talk about the whole developer advocacy stuff with you. But I just, again, this podcast is called Outside the Code. So I just want to get to know you a little bit better and wants the audience to get to know you better. And ultimately, we're kind of achieving the same goal here. So when did you go from doing advocacy work to suddenly saying, like, I want to teach people, right? And you're like a lead instructor at Launch Code, I believe. And I guess, were you kind of already teaching in some regards in as a developer advocate? And you're like, hey, you know, like maybe I could try teaching full time kind of thing.
Yeah. Several clarifications in there. But thinking about developer advocacy at the time was evangelism at Microsoft. I mean, it's all teaching and empathy and kind of learning from developers and seeing the pain points that they have with your products or building things, and then helping them learn and educate them on how to build stuff. So it was all, I did a decent amount of video content then. I did a lot of public speaking, a lot of workshops. So all the kind of standard things that you think of, I did. And there's a couple of different reasons that I ended up leaving. My wife and I moved to Memphis, and I was looking for a job because I couldn't find anything remote with Microsoft that made sense. So I started with FedEx as a software developer, which was great. I feel like at that point in my career, I needed like hands-on software, like full-time development experience, because that's just different than doing DevRel. Anyway, so I did that, and I realized, like, as I was doing it, like a year in or so, I was like, I just miss creating content. And it comes down to teaching, right? Like all content is teaching people or entertaining people in some regards. Mine's more teaching than entertaining, but
yeah, you got some entertainment value. I'll say now, I love I like your TikTok, especially the whole like the junior developer asking a senior developer, or it's the one where you're like trying a senior developer trying to give junior developer some advice, and the junior developer's just like ignoring all the advice possible, even though the senior's being really nice about it, which is like generally not the case. I cracked up so hard.
Yeah, it's hilarious that that is one of my most popular ones. And I actually feel like I did a poor representation of that. Was actually based on a real situation, and I feel like I poorly represented it. But anyway, because I don't feel like I portrayed myself as empathetically as I was in real life. So some people had comments the opposite of what you're saying, but
really? That's so crazy.
Well, what it came down to is like in the video, I was like, that's not real code. We should talk about it. And like saying that's not real code to somebody is not helpful. And people comment, and that is true. That's not exactly how it happened in real life. It was someone that I knew like really didn't have the skills and understanding yet. And I was really trying to go out of my way to say like, hey, let's take a step back. Let's talk about it. Let's learn from it. Anyway.
Sorry. What about was
the
that.
Yeah, no. So the original, oh, original
the transition
was...
from the FedEx a full stack developer to becoming a lead instructor. There was just something that was missing when you were working as a full stack developer that you kind of were itching to get back into, whatever that was.
Yeah, so it really started with just the content piece. So I started doing YouTube videos again back then and started writing articles. And I'd actually been offered a full-time job to teach a local boot camp called Code School, which is through a program called Code Crew, and I knew their founder. And I wasn't ready to like make that change yet. But the Launch Code thing was actually, it was outside of working full-time at FedEx. So those two things overlap. So Launch Code is a program that is at nights twice a week for like 6 months. And it's really amazing because it's free and it's after hours. So adults and people with family and people with jobs could still work their regular jobs, attend a boot camp for free, and then change careers in 6 months to a year. So it was like one of the coolest things to be a part of. But that came from them reaching out, having seen content. Like I always talk about how amazing content creation can be for you and your career and the opportunities that come from it. But yeah, they reached out, and I kind of debated about it just from a time commitment standpoint, because I'm kind of not selfish with my time. I'm just not quick to commit it on a consistent basis because it's a tough thing to do.
How ironic.
Yeah. Well,
your last name.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of quick jokes in there.
Sorry, go ahead.
But my wife kind of convinced me to do it. And so I did it and did one round again while I was still working at FedEx. And then they reached out again to do one virtually this in 2020, 2021. I couldn't tell you which year. I don't know. During COVID, I guess it was 21, and did a remote one for a group in Northwest Arkansas, and have had like similar impact there again of people going 6 months to a year, completely transitioning careers, more money, better culture, better benefits, all the things that we kind of talk and preach about.
Yeah, for me, I feel that I do pretty good with one-on-one coaching. But once I start involving a group, it starts getting a little difficult because everyone's at a different level generally, and you know, other people have different ways of learning. How did you cope with that, especially as like a lead instructor? That must have felt a little bit more pressure to just accommodate for so many students and all that.
Yeah, I think the thing that's number one in terms of importance for me is helping people feel comfortable asking questions, because that's the number one thing that I think people that aren't successful in a boot camp or something trying to make some sort of transition is you feel too uncomfortable to ask questions, and then you fall behind, and then you feel bad because you fall behind, and then you fall behind more, and you feel worse because you fell behind more. So it's trying to like catch that snowball early and help people build that trust and comfort level with people in the group that you have. So Launch Code is really interesting. It starts out at about 160 people. And with that many people, there would be about 15 TAs, so about 10 students per TA. And I would do like a lecture with everyone for the first hour. We'd break into groups and do, I don't remember what we called the activities, but some sort of like activities to like practice that stuff, and then come back and do kind of like a recap thing at the end. So I feel like I'm a pretty meta teacher. Like I pause and I do a lot of like, how are you feeling type questions to really understand like super get important. Them. Yeah.
Right. Just get
otherwise
the temperature of the room. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like sometimes I'm a little too meta with that, but I wanted to make sure that people were being honest with like, do you feel lost? Do you feel overwhelmed? And when people say that, like the first person that says it, the next person or the person next to them is like, yeah, me too. And that's the kind of thing that I think is helpful to know that like, this is stressful for everyone. Like this is one of the hardest things that people can ever do in their career is go through a boot camp. Like they're great. It's an amazing opportunity. It's hands down one of the hardest things you can ever do. And it takes like that community around you and the understanding that other people are going through the same thing and that it's going to be hard, but eventually you'll get there. So again, it was a lot of meta stuff. But it's tough with that many people. I could never have as many one-on-one interactions as I would like to, right? Like that's where I can have a deeper impact, but at that scale, you're just not quite able to do it. So I would try to do that when possible. I would bounce around between the different breakout rooms to like just kind of listen in or answer questions if there were any, but having a good set of TAs definitely makes that a lot easier.
Yeah, right. And eventually, after kind of going through the instruction route and then at FedEx full stack developer, maybe you just weren't getting still what you were looking for, right? And maybe that's kind of why now I kind of want to introduce the Auth0 path in your career. And you've kind of been, you were there for about almost like 2 years. Mm-hmm. And when you were jumping into that developer advocate position, like what were your expectations at Auth0?
I think the biggest thing for me is, like, I enjoyed my job at FedEx, but like you said, I was missing something. Like, I was spending all of these extra hours outside of work creating content and paying for myself to go to conferences and teaching a boot camp and stuff. And it's just like, why don't I just get paid to do that again? Because, like, I'm already doing it, and I want to be active in these communities. I want to be more active on Twitter. I want to be at more conferences and meetups and stuff. Why don't I just get paid to do exactly the thing that I want to do? And so that, like, I do a lot of like motivational type sessions when I get started talking about this stuff. Like if there's something you feel like you're missing, like just go figure out what it is and work towards it. Doesn't just change overnight, but go and like start to do research, start to look for opportunities. Who's in that job that you respect that you can reach out to and ask for advice and all that kind of stuff. So my expectations was just join a cool modern tech company, create content, teach people, speak at conferences, and do the thing that I was already doing, but for a company and get paid really well to do it.
I think that's what I struggle with a lot these days, especially as a content creator, or I don't even know what you call it, instructor in some regards, because I do like front end interview prep style videos on my channel. But it's always that struggle of being a software engineer and at the same time doing like content creation, but trying to like do that as a job, like dev advocacy. Do I really want to go full time into dev advocacy? Or like, is there some part of me that actually kind of just enjoys being a software developer? Or do I find like content creation fun because it's like a separation, right? Of like, this is my work time. And then in my fun time, I get to do like this mm-hmm. fun stuff of interviewing people like you, or, you know, like joining Twitter spaces is like, but if I start meshing those things together, and I think you mentioned it in an interview, like with, at a like Logs Rocket or something like that, like where it's like, you kind of have a hard time differentiating, like what is work and what is like, what is it for me kind of thing. And that's what I'm kind of always afraid of like, will I just blend my life? Like, will my whole life be a full-time job at that point? But can you give me some advice on what I should, like, maybe I'm overthinking this a little bit. I don't know.
I think it's all about the boundaries that you set. Like, my expectation for any company that I would join is I have complete ownership over the stuff that I do in my personal time. No one's going to tell me what to put on my YouTube channel. No one's going to tell me to take down something from my YouTube channel. I have complete ownership over that. And that's something I just can't sacrifice on. After that, they're like, yes, it sometimes can be hard to distinguish, but the good thing is, like, you don't really have to a lot. Like, think about me doing potentially, like, what seems like personal stuff on company time. If I'm doing stuff that is raising my credibility and awareness in the community, that's also beneficial for the company, right? Like, I'm not this person, but if I was the most well-known developer in the world, the company, whatever company I work at, is going to benefit from that, right? Like, the more people who know me, the more people who engage with me, the more people that trust that I provide value and, like, genuinely engage with people in the community, the better off my personal brand is, which is then better off for the company. So there's not, like, it can be hard to distinguish if you, like, really get down to it sometimes, but the good thing is it doesn't matter. Like, as long as I have that first boundary of, like, I own my personal content, it doesn't mean there's not overlap. It just means that's the thing that I have complete control over. And then there is overlap, because if I get better at creating a video from something I do at work, I'm going to be better at creating videos on my personal channel. If I get better at creating videos on my personal channel, that's going to make me a better video creator for my job. So yeah, I think you just kind of have to think about, like, what are the boundaries that you want to set for yourself, and make sure in interviews and conversations with whoever, that those things are clear, they make sense on both sides, and then just kind of run with it. I think for someone that's interested, unless you know you specifically want to do full-time development, which, like, I would never sacrifice that experience in my career for anything, because I needed it. But unless you know 100% that's what you want to do and not do content creation full-time, it seems like a win-win to me to be, like, a developer advocate full-time, because you get a mix of technical, you get to create content, you get to be out there and build your own brand while also building the brand of something else. So it's definitely been a good mix for me.
Seems like you found, like, a good win-win situation, like you described, like, get paid, but at the same time, you get to improve your other skill sets outside of coding, whether it's marketing or video editing, all of that stuff. And you're kind of able to leverage that single skill set into your brand and your company's brand. So you get the best of both, which is pretty awesome. When you joined in Auth0, like, did you only have a YouTube channel at the time? Did you have other social platforms? I know you got banned from Instagram, but are you still banned from Instagram?
My original account, yes, probably. Which there's no story to this, by the way. Like, I just woke up one day and didn't have access to Instagram. So it's not that I have any, like, hidden secret past that I haven't shared with people. So I've recreated Instagram. I have it. I'm not super active on it just because I spend so much time elsewhere. And the other question, sorry.
How many social platforms did you have you joined Auth0?
Yeah. So I was, like, relatively active on Twitter. I had my YouTube channel, and then I had written a bunch of articles for a platform called Scotch.io, which has since been acquired by DigitalOcean. So a good friend of mine, Chris Sev, ran that and then now works for DigitalOcean. And that was about it. I think I had like a course on Udemy, the VS Code course. So that one was out there. But it was mainly the YouTube channel that I talked about in terms of, like, content creation and thinking about, like, getting into DevRel, like, on, like, resumes are just words on a piece of paper. But if you go and see that I've got 100 videos on technical topics, you know, I know how to create content. I know how to teach people. I know how to learn new stuff. Right. So that's, like, the ultimate proof for something in DevRel is, like, just, like, if you want to know, go and look at all these videos and judge for yourself.
Yeah. And I'm just kind of curious, because you did say that something along the lines of, I wanted people to see my personality more. And we kind of alluded to that in the beginning. Did you feel that with your current set of social platforms and how you're utilizing it I'm just trying to, like, set the timeline a bit, but when you're at Auth0, were you kind of thinking about that aspect, or was that a little bit later down the line when you're like, I want people to see my personality more?
I've had that in mind, like, on kind of my yearly notes when I look forward or look to the next year. I've probably had that in my notes for 3 or 4 years now. Wow. But I still don't feel like I've done a good job. And part of the answer is just like, there's only so much time in the day. So I'm pretty lenient with myself. Like, I'm not like super regretful that I haven't done a bunch of stuff because it's just not possible to do everything. But I would say that's been on my mind for 4 years probably. And TikTok most recently has been that outlet that's probably most relevant to just having something different than the average tutorial stuff.
Yeah. And did that stem from comparing yourself to other people where like they do show personalities and you're like, well, maybe I should show my personalities? Because I think I heard something along the lines of there's nothing wrong with comparing yourself to other people as long as you do it in your own like respectful way. These are kind of my paraphrasing of your words, I believe. But like, were you seeing other people showing their personalities and you're like, oh, maybe I don't have to always just do like these tutorials, or like, you know, maybe I could share my opinions about why JavaScript is not necessarily good at times or whatever, right? Whatever topics I want to talk about. Like, what kind of stemmed that 4 year thought?
So that one specifically really didn't come from the comparison thing. But I'll kind of talk about that. So I am pretty adamant. Like, people say don't compare yourself because you're just kind of like setting yourself up for failure and imposter syndrome and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like the complete opposite. Like, I would never have accomplished the things that I have in my career and my personal content creation had I not looked at other people and what they've done and how they've been able to do it to envision that that's possible. Like, we only have so much creativity to think something's possible that we've never seen done before. And so I think comparing yourself and looking at other people that have the job that you want or are doing the job that you want and you think they're doing it better, compare yourself to them, like see what they're doing and see what you can learn from them to iterate on your process and get better. But like you said, you have to do that in a safe space of knowing, like, I'm going to compare myself. Everybody has different backgrounds, experience levels, paths and journeys and all this sort of stuff. So it's not, you have to make sure you use it as kind of a motivational and an awareness thing of what's possible and not like a comparison. I'm going to feel bad and like not do work because I feel bad type thing.
Right. Right. That makes sense. And who were your inspirations that you were comparing yourself to, maybe specifically to your YouTube channel? Because I think you said you hit about 100. Your goal was to hit 100,000 subs last year, maybe. Mm-hmm. And who are you? Whose channels were you looking at to be like, oh, if they could do it, I should, or this is the comparison game in a, again, positive way. But who did you find inspiration from?
Yeah. There's so many in our Discord, which is super cool to be a part of. But specifically, Florin Pop and CodeStacker, Jesse, and The Coder, those are, and Anya Kubo are like four channels that I've like super looked up to. We're like in similar ranges, although I think I've been surpassed by most of them at this point. But I remember Jesse from the CodeStacker channel, he did a write-up on Free Code Camp. Wow, I can't believe it took me that long to think of that. He did a write-up on Free Code Camp about how we got to 100,000 subscribers in a year. And like, the imposter syndrome for me was like, I've been doing videos since 2013 and I took a couple years off, and then I've been doing them consistently for longer than Jesse had been doing them. So it's easy to just sit there and kind of be like, well, maybe I just don't have it. Maybe I need to give up. Maybe it's not worth it anymore. But if you take the other approach and look at like, well, dang, he just created really good content over the course of, you know, a year, and he paid attention to what people responded to. That sort of thing is now possible. So I started to have, at the end of the year before last, I started to have some growth from a couple of videos that caught on, got to 30,000. And then I just gave myself this goal of 100,000. And at the end of 2021, not knowing how feasible it was for me, but knowing that it's possible for someone because I've seen it. And ended up, I don't know what I ended up at, 110 or 120 or something. So I made it past that number, which I thought at the time was just like, I'm going to put this number out there and see what happens. But I think it's like the meta, like, put positive thoughts out there and it's much more likely to happen. And I think it just comes from a mentality of thinking it's possible versus comparing yourself in the negative way and thinking about what you haven't been able to do and not what you could do in the future.
Right. I really resonate with that, because as a smaller creator, I have about 4,000 subs-ish, and you get a little stubborn with the way you want to put out content, and it resonates with a small few, but if you cannot sacrifice, maybe just like you're not just doing like clickbaity stuff or just like random stuff that you don't kind of believe in, but if you can it still stay consistent with that, but then add a little bit of clickbaity stuff, like it doesn't have to go 100%, it could just be a little bit just to get the viewer's attention, maybe add a few more b-rolls, all of these little things can make such a significant difference. But sometimes, you know, like people don't really look at their channel though. Like maybe even myself, I need to reevaluate my channel and figure out like, hey, like what resonates very well. I did like a whole reaction video to like a JavaScript interviewer like skit that someone did, and that has the best views of all the views I've ever done in some regards. So like I'm still learning, I'm still trying to figure out what will make me happy, but at the same time, you know, try to hit these goals. And obviously your guys' your channel and like all the people that you mentioned, they're like kind of on this like different level compared to me in my eyes. But it's a good goal to have, to know that hey, we're all in the tech industry, we're all coders, we could all like hit that number. So I definitely am trying to go at my own pace, but at the same time, you know, sometimes I think it's good to maybe use that as motivation to accelerate it as well. So I that definitely resonated with that when you said like, hey, you know, like comparison is not a bad thing as long as you just do it in the right way. So yeah, that makes sense.
And there's not like more optimism. I feel like there's not a lot. There are a lot of content creators that are at your level, maybe a little bit below, that I love their content and is just as good as mine. So there's some level of just like you kind of get lucky and a video catches on and that's game changing for your channel. There's a couple of things that I've done with working with other people. I published a couple of videos on the Traverse Media channel, one on Free Code Camp. So those gave me spikes. And then I had a couple that just kind of took off on my own. So it's just for everyone that's creating good content, regardless of what size, you're kind of just like a few breaks away from really having that growth that I think people are looking for. And you mentioned the clickbaity stuff, which is a conversation that I had on the Log Rocket Pocket podcast too. There's this balance of like making sure you provide good value and genuine content, but like you have to give people a reason to watch it too. So you have to like make those thumbnails and titles enticing enough so people see them. They're like, okay, there's some urgency here. This is something I feel like I need to watch and or read or listen to or whatever it is. So that's like the marketing aspect of it. But I try to make sure all the time that I'm like gauging the feedback that people have, like comments and likes and that kind of stuff, to see if they're starting to have, you know, questionable comments of this didn't provide the value that the thumbnail suggested it would, then I need to step back and make sure that I am providing that value first and foremost. But learning how to make it something that people want, I think, is the number one thing that I've tweaked in the last year to kind of help that growth with my channel.
I am curious, did your job at Auth0 going from developer advocate to developer marketing media manager, did that help in any way where you start thinking like a marketing person, not necessarily just like a pure dev advocate, like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, do tasks related to more technical advocacy versus like now I have to think about marketing from a higher architectural level in some regards?
I think that more came from my personal experience. Oh, okay, got it. With YouTube, which then influenced my ability to, I mean, they created that title and position like for me out of my interest to not necessarily be in management, but to be more of a leader in our developer marketing space. So that job kind of came out of those conversations that I had with my manager and director at the time. But I think I was enabled and in a good spot to be able to advocate for something like that because of my experience with personal content.
Yeah, you're like the perfect example of using your content or your brand to improve your company and your company to improve your brand. So it's just pretty awesome to see that it's kind of going in full circle that way. So why did you leave Auth0? Was it because of Will Johnson? We could just kind of just lay it down right now and just announce it's because of Will Johnson that you had to leave Auth0, right?
So what was the timing on that? Will joined and then I left like, here's the worst potential. My wife actually joined the team at Auth0 on the same team for a couple of months before I left, which was like a super positive thing. And she's still really happy there. And like we both work from home, so I get to listen in on, or not creepily, but like I'll pop in on Zoom call sometimes so I can say hey to my teammates and stuff from Moss Zero. And so it's really cool to have her tied into like the ecosystem and everything.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I was super happy. I was a big advocate for getting Will to join at Moss Zero. So I was super happy that that worked out. The one thing that didn't work out though is I've forgotten about this until now, and it upsets me, is I left like 30 days too early to get the referral bonus for Will. So I forget how much it was, but like I would have gotten a referral bonus had I stuck around like 30 more days or whatever. But
wait, can I ask another question?
Yeah.
Did you refer your wife as well?
So she is right now a contractor. But will be full time. I don't know if that's public knowledge, but put it out there anyway. Should be full time soon. But she was a contractor, so there wasn't a referral bonus for that.
I was gonna say you missed out on two referral bonuses, possibly not just one.
Yeah.
Retroactively update or something.
I know. What could have been?
What could have been?
Yeah. But I think I was looking for something smaller, really. I heard a lot of people at All Zero talk about kind of like the good old days, the younger days when marketing was a team of 10 people as a whole versus 100 or whatever the number is at that point. And then they had gotten acquired by Okta, which is just a little bit different, right? Like you're joining now, like it's a much bigger company than what it was when I started. And I wanted to be a part of kind of building something more from scratch. And so opportunity came up at Planet Scale, much younger company. I think it was around 80 when I joined, and we've hired a few people since then. And it's also another learning experience for me. I didn't know anything about authentication, authorization before getting to Auth0. So that's a skill set that I have been able to build or was able to build over the course of a couple of years. And now databases, like I've done very basic stuff in the past, but more or less had no database knowledge coming into this role. And now I know a lot more and I'm continuing to learn more and more about how databases work. So I feel like it's kind of a good like culture and younger company type thing for me. And also just a kind of rounding out my technical skills and knowledge experience being there.
Would you say you more prefer to be in these smaller teams? Like you're kind of talking about going from Auth0 where they're kind of growing, they got bought out and now they've been growing and you kind of wanted to start from ground floor a little bit here, but like all successful companies, they're eventually going to grow, right? Like, is it for in your eyes, is it as long as I start from the ground up and see it grow, it'll be fine, but maybe if I join mid or later and it grows even more, like I'm not too sure about that. Like, what's your opinion on like how you approach it, or is it just kind of like a gut feeling?
Yeah, I think I would go even smaller in the future. I coming from FedEx and Microsoft, right? Like these are multi hundred thousand people companies. So that's like a totally different ball game. But it's really wild to be at an offsite and just like hang out with the CEO. Like Sam is super cool. We were in our offsite in New Orleans last week. See him. He's just a regular person like everybody else, right? And so are all the different leaders in the company. And that's the kind of stuff that I want to be a part of early on, and whenever the next job is, or full-time content creation, like who knows, but whatever the next job would be, if it was joining another company, it would be probably even smaller than Planet Scale is now, just to be a part of that like initial growth, knowing the people across the board at the company that you work at, having access to leadership and them just kind of being regular people that you can talk to and have a conversation with. And then being able to make like tangible impact, not that you can't in other places, but it's just easier to see your contributions when you're so small and you're trying to build stuff out.
Right. And at your current position as a staff developer advocate, like my understanding of advocacy is so like kind of, I have no idea how leveling works as an advocate. So what would a staff advocate be doing that a senior advocate would it be doing, and what a mid-level would it be doing, and then what a junior advocate would it be doing? Like, yeah, how are so many levels? Is it kind of similar to like software developer structure where you're thinking about like architecture versus, I don't know, like, I guess it just gets more ambiguous as it goes higher. Is that it?
Yeah, I think like developer advocacy is still a newer thing. So I think that's probably something that there's not a great answer to across the board, but with any sort of progression in a career ladder, it's all about kind of like sphere of influence. Traditionally, like as a entry-level developer, for example, like you're really figuring stuff out for yourself. when you look at becoming like a senior developer, you're pretty comfortable with the stuff that you know and learning on your own. And now you're starting to like push that knowledge out a little bit to other people on your team. Maybe you're kind of working with people on a different team, but you're kind of learning and sharing, and that scope, that sphere of influence is growing. You go beyond that, and now you're really working across teams. And that was kind of the progression that I had at FedEx of moving into eventually architecture, of now like coordinating with different teams and going in between them. For developer advocacy, it's newer. So like that same idea is there. It's like your sphere of influence and impact and stuff. But at the same time, at such a young company like we are, there's really not that much division of who's doing what, because everybody has to be really involved. So it's kind of similar stuff. I think the title for me really just comes from experience. I mean, at this point in my career, I've done developer advocacy specifically like for a company 5 or 6 years. I've been creating content over the course of like 10 years, and I have a pretty good brand on my own. So I think the staff part here specifically just comes with experience. A lot of that would also be like mentorship to people who are joining the team that are either newer to some of the technologies, newer to content creation, newer to public speaking, like being a mentor in that sense, but also being able to collaborate across teams and being able to, something we've talked about internally, kind of run with ideas on your own, that kind of like independence of being able to take something from an idea and actually go and execute on it without needing a ton of oversight or influence from other people.
Right. And this kind of goes to the point of you saying that, you know, getting an idea and then run with it and being able to build it. I've heard some mixed responses about people in developer advocacy. Like, do I need to be a software developer first to join developer advocacy? Can I just join developer advocacy right away without maybe a full-time software developer job prior? Like, what's your opinion on that? I know it could be somewhat controversial, but maybe you, as someone that has done this for 5-6 years and possibly could be hiring many junior to mid-level developers in the future, like what kind of tips would you give them? And like, do you recommend maybe like a year in after you could start looking into it? Like, what's the go-to way? I know there's no one solution, but yeah.
Yeah. Short answer, you do whatever works, right? Like all of that is an option. The more detailed answer, I started my career off. My first job was a technical evangelist, basically a developer advocate. And that was game changing for my career, like learning the confidence to build communities, to be involved in communities, to give talks. Like at the age of 22, I was giving talks to developers that had been writing code as long as I'd been alive. Right. It's a really weird thing, but it was also such a great learning experience, and the connections that I made and the confidence that I built and doing that was game changing for me going forward. But the thing I didn't have was that level of technical expertise to go a level deeper than what I was. And one of the traps that's easy to fall into, happens with me and most developer advocates now too, is you do demos, right, for a talk or a video. And they're usually kind of beginner demos. So you kind of lack some of that deeper technical expertise. So the big thing that I do recommend at some point in your career, even if it's not the first thing you do, is have full-time software development experience. Like that was really critical for me, because now I can walk into a developer advocate position. I can say I know how to give talks. I know how to create videos. I know how to do content. I know how to lead a workshop. I know how to do that stuff. But I also have some technical chops, some technical experience that I can relate back to and communicate to further earn trust in the developer community. I would probably think that the route that makes the most sense, if I were to give a suggestion, is to start as a software developer and do that for several years. Create content along the way to kind of show that that's something that you want to do, to prove when you go into an interview that you have some of that experience. Give talks at local meetups, like whatever the smallest thing is that you can do to get that first one and get the first couple or whatever. And then maybe you do bigger ones, and then kind of like direct yourself towards a career in developer advocacy as you go along. At least at that point, you would have that technical experience day in and day out, and you can build those other skills along the way.
Right. That makes total sense. And obviously with developer advocacy, it's going to be a mixture of, like you said, like speaking, maybe content creation, and then you kind of have to know a bit of code, it sounds like. So that seems to be like the perfect recipe. I'm curious, I know you said something along the lines, again, like I never force myself to do certain things. I just do what I enjoy. And this is kind of more in relation to like, how do you manage all your work and like, how do you be so consistent with the type of work that you're doing? But, you know, you could be a little honest with me. Like, are there days where you do stuff that you don't enjoy because you just have to do it?
There's definitely things like formal. Well, yes, the short answer is definitely yes. And it's all admin work for me, is stuff I don't enjoy. Like on the personal side, it's.
But like the once a week videos things, like, aren't there days there sometimes you're just like, oh, this is, unless you do like a scheduling thing where you kind of do a lot of videos at once and then kind of schedule ahead of time, like are you consistently making one video per week, like on a weekend or a weekday, and then you're like, I'm gonna do it for the next week kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm not good at getting ahead on videos. A lot of other people are much better. So yes, there's like some of the admin stuff, so we want to get away from that and talk about, do I ever struggle to actually create the content? The only time that gets tough is if I've potentially taken on a sponsor video and it's just like, I'm not getting to where I want to be as quickly as possible. And that's tough, right? Because there's a learning experience that comes along with it, which is factored into like my time and my rates and that kind of stuff. So that can be tough if it's not as easy as an onboarding experience as I want. But like I generally, when I talk about like, I don't create content that I don't want to, I genuinely mean that. So like sometimes it's a little harder than others, and sometimes it feels like a chore, but for the most part it doesn't. And I think the number one reason why that's true for me in comparison to other content creators is I don't over engineer my videos. Like I don't edit a ton. I don't script anything. I don't rehearse anything. And so it's a lot easier for me time wise to create content. So where someone else might take 6 to 8 hours to do a video, because one of their good qualities is they're a perfectionist and they have this really high level of expectations for themselves. For me, I'm not a perfectionist. And so it's easier for me to ship like slightly less quality content, still very quality content, but slightly less than some other people in an hour. Like the video that I published this morning, I wrote 3 notes, like bullet points for the video, and I recorded it and edited it and published in an hour. And that makes it so much easier for me, right? Because it's not an all day thing. And I don't have time to do all those other things. Like some of it is really nice. And I have a lot of respect for people that have really fine editing and they've got all these animations and pop in text. And that stuff is really cool. I love it. But it's just worked out well for me to keep the consistency over. I've never sacrificed consistency over a higher quality product, because the quality from feedback and comments and likes and views and stuff has been more than enough for the growth that I've been looking for and the time that I have or don't have.
We never have enough time. I think that's one thing that I've learned. Yeah. The last thing I want to ask you about is your tagline. I teach developers through content. How did you come up with that tagline? Well, did you have a tagline before, or was this just like, I want to come up with a tagline, this is what I represent?
Yeah. For a while I've kind of used developer, speaker, and teacher. And I think that's still a really good representation. So that's going to be some part of my brand as well. But I think I teach developers through content hits all the things. Like if you just wanted to know one sentence about me, that hits the things. Like I'm a teacher. That comes with creating content, which is there in the word. So that implies that like, I'm not just in a classroom and I'm teaching. Like I teach people through content, which is YouTube videos and blog posts and being on podcasts and all these things. I'm specifying the audience. Like I am a developer. You can't teach developers if you're not a developer. So I'm kind of throwing in my technical background too. And so I just think it hits, like it's a good summation of what I do. And I think like you kind of hear about taglines and branding and stuff, and like short and sweet and memorable is what works the best. And so for me, that like those couple of subtle buzzwords really envelop, I don't know if that's the right word, but really encompass like all the things that I do in just a couple of words.
Right. I mean, you do a lot of different things, but just being able to just simplify it in a single sentence that just resonates really hard to say, I teach developers through content. It makes sense. Like it's simple, it's straight to the point, and everyone understands what you do. Like whatever content represents, that's up to whoever is reading it to decide. So if you want to, you know, just tag your banned Instagram account here, this will be a perfect good time to do it. But on a serious note, James, before we close out, like, are there any social plugs or anything that you want to kind of share with us before we end this episode?
Yeah, James Q Quick on basically everything: YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, although not super active, TikTok, all those things. And then I'll plug my podcast co-host and I, Amy Dutton, are working on a course called Everything Svelte at everythingsvelte.com. And it's a Svelte kit course that is working with Supabase and Tailwind and a bunch of other really cool stuff. So we've been working on that for a couple of months, and we're hoping to launch sometime in the spring, probably late April, more likely early May. So that's going to be a big deal for us, and we're excited to share it with people.
Yeah, super excited about that. And for everyone that stayed till the end of the episode, thank you for listening to Outside the Code, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a comment to show support. This episode will be available on YouTube and various other podcast platforms. Tech Rally out.